Tweet at TodaySOR.
2 years have passed since the centenary of the 1913 lockout. It's an event impossible to talk about without mentioning the name of Jim Larkin. And yet, it's worth noting that in 1959, there was a publication marking 50 years of Liberty Hall that didn't mention the Larkin name at all. It seems that big Jim Larkin has been poorly served by history when compared to his contemporary James Connolly. Historian Emmett O'Connor has written what's been billed as the first full-length biography of big Jim Larkin, a book that poses the following question as its subtitle, Hero or Wrecker. Who better to answer that than Emmett O'Connor, who's with me now. Thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
First of all, Larkin is very much associated with the foundation of the Irish trade union movement, but his involvement goes back much further than that. I mean, I think he first made a bit of an impact in Belfast, is that right?
Yeah, he was born in 1874 in Liverpool, and he was sent to Ireland in January 1907 to begin the reorganisation of the Irish ports for the National Union of Dock Labourers, a Liverpool-based union, which is known in Britain as the Irish Union because there are so many Irish in it. And his work there led to the famous Dockers and Carters strike in the summer of 1907, which is remarkable for causing the police mutiny. At one point, the RIC mutinied and they joined the strikers, and this really panicked the government. It made Larkin a household name. And it made Dublin Castle afraid he might do the same in the south of Ireland.
So he had he made a bit of an impact in Belfast, and then he founded the Irish Transport and General Workers Union in 1909. How did that come about?
Yeah, he had it was a mixture of objective and subjective factors. He had personality differences with Sexton, his general secretary, and the more popular Larkin became, the more he wanted to do his own thing in his own way, not have to answer to anyone for it. But as well as that, he felt that there were particular problems of the Irish working class. The British unions, he felt, the British labour movement couldn't solve these problems, and what was needed was an Irish union to address the problems of Irish workers.
It'll come as a surprise to people to learn that, or some people anyway, that while Larkin was a strong trade unionist, he wasn't a great believer in strikes.
Yeah, he often said that he didn't believe in strikes, and I think it's true. His enemies, and indeed his friends too, presented him as a kind of reckless militant. I mean, James Sexton said he'd order a strike as casually as he'd order bacon and eggs for breakfast. But if you look at his behaviour, he often went to a great deal of trouble to avoid strikes. But when a strike started, he'd get stuck in, he'd roll up his sleeves and he'd go all out to win.
At what stage then, you mentioned about the authorities in Dublin Castle being wary of this man, and then of course there was that great confrontation in the lockout, but how long had that been brewing, the 1913 lockout?
Well, Larkin always had the ambition of organising transport workers, because dockers were casual workers. They might have the union dues this week, they mightn't have it next week. So he felt that the future survival of the union really depended on organising steady sectors, steady employment sectors. And he was also inclined to target Murphy. Larkin always personalised everything. He always wanted to put a face on it. He wouldn't attack capitalism or wage slavery. He'd attack a particular employer.
In this case, William Martin Murphy.
And William Martin Murphy was the obvious target in Dublin. So I suppose certainly from, arguably from 1909, from the beginning, certainly from the middle of 1911, I think that trouble was brewing between Larkin and Murphy.
Now, the other great figure, of course, who would be associated with this period was James Connolly. How did Larkin and Connolly get on, or did they?
They're kind of remembered as the two great heroes, sort of two equal heroes of the movement. But Larkin was far and away the main man, and he kept on letting Connolly know that. Connolly was good at persuading people who were willing to sit down and listen to him, but Larkin could stand the street corners and he could bring in the masses. Connolly just didn't have Larkin's. Nobody had Larkin's agitational ability, and Larkin was a terrible man for jealousy, and he could be very overbearing with Connolly, who didn't like him at all.
But interestingly, after the lockout, there was need to kind of revive the Irish Citizen Army, and that was Larkin's doing.
Yeah, again, people associate the Citizen Army, with Connolly, and republicanism, socialist republicanism with Connolly. But I mean, it was really Larkin who made these things. It was he who revived the Citizen Army with Sean O'Casey. Connolly was in Belfast at that time. And Larkin said, when the World War broke out in August 1914, it was Larkin who said, we have to have a rising before this war ends.
And then he went to America.
Yeah, he was worn out after the lockout. He personalised it very much. He took the defeat very personally. He had a lot of problems adjusting to the end of the lockout. He always had difficulties in adjusting to defeat. And I think he was just fed up with trade union work. I think he wanted a new career as a freelance global agitator.
And how long did he spend in the United States?
He was there from November of 1914 to April of 1923.
That's nearly 10 years. That's, 9 years anyway.
9 years. And it's a crucial 9 years because he misses the whole independence struggle.
And apparently he advised Connolly to sort of pull back from the idea of a rising, even though he'd originally called for it.
Yeah, that was a kind of contradiction, that he was very much in favour of a rising. But when he felt that it might go ahead in his absence and he wouldn't be part of it, he sent two messages to Connolly to pull out of it, as he put it, because he knew that, you know, when it actually happened, he knew he'd been upstaged big time, and Connolly was now the hero of the movement, and he could be forgotten about.
So what did he do in America?
He kind of dithered. The idea was to become a sort of public speaker, to go on the lecture circuit, as people like Oscar Wilde and others had done, Hannah Shee, Skeffington. But he could never get himself sufficiently organised to do that, at least to make money out of it. And he kind of dithered between working with the socialists and working with the IRB, Clonagale. And eventually he was down on his luck, and he took a job as a union organiser with the Western Federation of Miners, which is a rough, tough job, not the kind of work he wanted. And I think in desperation, he contacted the German embassy and he agreed to become a German agent in October of 1915.
That landed him in trouble.
Yeah, especially when the war broke out. Or at least when the United States entered the war in April of 1917. And he was proximate to a lot of notorious German acts of sabotage, notably the Black Tom explosion in New York Harbor. And, you know, the Bureau of Investigation, later the FBI, they were on his tail. And he had a number of, you know, close calls.
And he did time, as you said. Two very interesting things about that. One, the attitude of his wife, Elizabeth, whom he married, I think, just at the start of the century, 1903 or thereabouts, when she was asked to get involved in a campaign to have him released.
Yeah. As Big Jim's grandson said, it was a marriage of chalk and cheese. She wanted a quiet life. She eventually kind of got fed up with the turbulence. She did go over and join him in America, but only for about 7 or 8 months. And then when he was in jail, she was asked to join the campaign for his release, and she refused.
I suppose it said something about the state of the marriage, if she was happier to say, well, at least she was prepared to see him stay in jail rather than help to try and get him out. And then the name J. Edgar Hoover comes into the story.
J. Edgar Hoover, he was making his way, you know, as a big man in the FBI. And there was a Red Scare in the US, 1919, 1920. And Hoover believed that all this, these red problems, they were due to these foreign agitators coming over from Europe, bringing this foreign, un-American ideology from Europe. And Larkin was just typical of these foreigners, and the way to deal with them was to deport them. So Hoover wanted to get Larkin deported.
How did he do that?
He eventually, he really couldn't get adequate, he needed evidence that Larkin had advocated violence, and he couldn't get it. But he eventually got evidence that Larkin had asked people to contribute money to the socialist cause, and using the phrase, every dollar kills the capitalist. And he claimed that this was proof that Larkin had advocated violence.
So having done his time for criminal anarchy in 1920, he found himself back here then in 1923.
Yeah, he was deported from the US in April of 1923 to Southampton. He met some of the Communist Party leaders in London. And then he arrives in Dublin on the 30th of April, 1923.
And at that stage, of course, the newly formed Irish state was beginning to get up and running. So how did he immerse himself in public affairs, or did he? What did
he do? Yeah, so much had changed. You see, you had the whole War of Independence, the creation of the state. But the Transport Union had changed as well. It was a different union from when Larkin had founded it. Other people had taken over. And they weren't just going to step aside and let Larkin, you know, return as a kind of dictatorial type of leader. So the plan was to create a 5-man collective leadership. And had Larkin be willing to accept that, he'd have his wings clipped. But if he'd be willing to sort of be part of that 5-man leadership, you know, he had a sinecure really for the rest of his life. Because the name was important to the union, but he couldn't accept it. He couldn't stomach the idea of other people running his union. as you saw it. And the great tragedy of the thing was that when he came back to Ireland, he didn't want union work. He wanted to be a freelance agitator, as he had been in America.
And then there was the formation of the Workers' Union of Ireland. Now, was he involved in that?
No, he wasn't. Again, people assumed that he formed it on breaking away from the Transport Union. But he'd been invited to attend the Communist International Congresses in Moscow. And he'd finally went to Moscow in June of 1924. And in his absence, his brother Peter and his son Young Jim, his eldest son Young Jim, they formed the Workers' Union of Ireland. And when Big Jim came back to Dublin in August, he had no choice except to lead this new union.
But did he want it formed?
No, he didn't, no. He wanted to stick with the Transport Union because...
So his brother and his son acted, they went behind his back when he was out of the country.
Exactly. As soon as he was out of the country, they took steps to form this union.
And, well, he could have quashed it, presumably, but he just chose to go with it, yeah?
Well, because, I mean, that was now his livelihood. If he'd quashed it, you know, his position in the Transport Union was gone. He had no way of getting it back by August of 1924, so he really had to accept the new dispensation.
And what kind of rivalry then went down the decades between those two unions?
Oh, there was virtually a civil war in the Dublin Labour Movement between, you know, 1923 and the 1950s, even 1960s. I mean, even today, there are still tensions over this issue. The two unions came together as SIPTU in 1990, but you still find in SIPTU people who are Transport Union people and other people who are WUI people.
Yeah. You say he wanted to move away from trade union activity after the lockout, but even though he had been absent for the 9 years, as we referred to earlier, he found himself right back at the heart of it. But I suppose he didn't know anything else, or did he know anything else when he came back?
Well, he did have the possibility of becoming a freelance agitator. But again, you know, his personality got in the way, and that was really the story of his life. The communists were willing to give him money from Moscow as a freelance agitator if he would set up a communist party. But he knew that if he set up a communist party, you know, a real genuine communist party, it would be controlled from Moscow. He'd be accountable to Moscow. And he couldn't stomach the idea of being accountable to anyone.
What about direct politics, though, and political activity here?
Well, he did engage, not in the 20s, but in the 30s. Well, in the 20s, he was elected to Dáil. He was the only communist ever elected to Dáil Éireann as a communist in 1927, but he couldn't take a seat because he was an undischarged bankrupt. So he lost his seat. But he got elected to Dublin Corporation when it was re-established.
Presumably as an independent, or was it as a communist?
To begin with, as a communist, yeah, as a kind of an independent communist, yeah.
And how would you summarise his achievements then? I mean, to come back to the title of the book, Emmett, Hero or Wrecker?
Yeah, the great challenge, this challenge I suppose in all biography, but the great challenge of writing a biography about Larkin is to do justice to the fact that he was a hero, that he had such a great impact on trade unionism between 1907 and 1914. I mean, they were the glory years. How do you recount the other years? You know,
In other words, in building support for the concept and in pulling people in to get involved and to show solidarity towards
it. Oh, yeah, and also in building up an Irish trade union, because the Irish trade union movement had been in decline from, you could say, from the 1820s. They've been dissolving into the British Labour movement, and Larkin reversed that and he formed an Irish Labour movement.
One of the extraordinary things about this story is that we're talking here about somebody who was a communist in the earlier part of the last century, somebody who got married in a registry office, and yet he seemed to have a rapport with high clerics from the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I mean, actually he was quite friendly with Bishop Brown of Galway, who, when Bishop Brown was chairman of the Commission of Vocational Organisation. And he was also quite friendly with Archbishop John Charles McQuaid. So he was able to establish those sort of personal
friendships. Was there some sort of a deathbed conversion or at least encounter with John Charles McQuaid?
Yeah, Larkin was always a bit ambiguous about his views on religion and the afterlife and the church and so on. He could be very anti-clerical, but at the same time could be very defensive of the Catholic Church. He told John Swift, a sort of famous atheist, that he was going to Liverpool to escape from the possibility of getting a religious funeral in 1946. But a few months later, he slipped and fell, and he was taken to hospital. And when the clergy heard about this, they did put pressure on him to make a sort of deathbed conversion, and he was given what many of his comrades saw as a kind of a show Catholic funeral.
And what about the funeral itself? Was it a big event in Dublin?
It's a huge event, even though it was an absolutely miserably It was a miserable day, bitterly cold, but it was a huge event in Dublin. That was in January of 1947.
The book is called Big Jim Larkin, Hero or Wrecker by Emmett O'Connor. Emmett, thank you very much indeed for coming in. It's published by UCD Press and it sells for around about €40.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.